are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. From historical accounts to modern cases, explore the captivating psychology behind these killer women, unraveling their motives and unveiling the dark complexities of human behavior. The fair sex. We've often heard this cliched expression being used to refer to women. Although it has become increasingly outdated, the mindset still exists that women are the gentle and nurturing sex. When it comes to murder, that notion gets turned on its head. And this isn't a recent phenomenon. We can find plenty of female killers going back in history. In fact, some of the world's most notorious serial killers have been women. These female killers give their male counterparts a run for their money and deserve to be counted among the most famous serial killers. Unearth the disturbing histories of notorious women. From the chilling accounts of infamous Black Widow murders to the spine-tingling narratives of women who shocked the world with their sinister deeds, this anthology delves deep into the minds of these deadly women. Spanning eras and continents, these tales of true crime offer a chilling exploration of the darkest corners of human nature. The book that we're featuring this evening is Women Who Murder, an international collection of deadly true crime tales, with my special guest, author and editor, Mitzi Soretto. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Mitzi Soretto.
Hi, Dan. Thanks so much for having me back. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, and congratulations on the newest book, Women Who Murder.
Yeah, I know. It's been a whirlwind since this all started with the true crime books.
Absolutely. Tell us about the table of contents for this one and the authors in this collection.
Sure. We've got several authors from around the world. The first story, I'll go in order here, Down in the Ditch, Joanna Dennehy, Serial Stabber, which is by Charlotte Platt. Next up is Ruth Snyder, The Original Femme Fatale, which is by Kieran Conliff. Then we have Innocence Taken, The Murder of Carissa Boudreau, which is by Mike Brown. Then we have Mahin, Monster or Victim, which is by me. Then we've got Twisted Firestarter, which is by C.L. Raven, followed by On the Courthouse Steps, The Trial of Susan Smith by Kathy Pickens, followed by Angelina Napolitano, I Am Not a Bad Woman by Ed Butts. Then we have The Strange Case of Kelly Lane by Anthony Ferguson, followed by Jolly Joseph, The Kerala Cyanide Serial Killer by Shashi Kadapa. Then we have Women Fight Back by Tom Larson, Beauty and Beast by Ely Goyanas, Ana Bisesto, Ana Funesto by Alicia Holland, Dead Woman Walking by Joan Renner, and we conclude with Mona Fandy, The Malaysian Murderer by Chang Shi Yen.
So an international collection. Some authors are returning from your previous collections.
Correct. Yes, yes. And some new people have arrived on the scene as well.
Yes, and these stories surround some extraordinary cases, international stories that certainly people have not heard about before. Let's talk about your own story, Mahin, Monster or Victim.
Yes, this was a really interesting one to write. You know, I guess I like to challenge myself by finding really obscure stories that are, you really have to go ferret out information left and right. This is actually about Iran's first known female serial killer. It's got so many dimensions to it. It's just you know, I mean, we think of serial killers that are women, you know, Eileen Wuornos is one of the notorious ones that comes to mind. But in Maheen's case, there's just so many dimensions to her story, which is why I subtitled it Monster or Victim, basically leaving it to the reader to decide, was she a monster or was she a victim?
You write early on in this story that in the early 2000s, there were a number of serial killers with very, very high body counts, including the Spider Killer. Can you tell us about a few of the killers that you include before we start talking about Maheen?
Sure. You know, I was actually quite surprised by this. I mean, I guess, you know, we tend to think of serial killing as being a popular pastime in the West, as mm-hmm. it is. You know, there does seem to be a lot more serial killers in Western cultures. But in the 21st century, just with, you know, and we're only, what, 24 years into that century, there's been some pretty heinous serial killers in Iran. As you referenced, the Spider Killer, Saeed I'm sorry, I'll mangle his last name. Let's just call him the Spider Killer. He actually targeted female sex workers in Mashhad, saying he was cleansing the city of moral corruption. And apparently it looks like his known victim tally was 16. Then there was the Tehran desert vampire, whose name is Mohammad Bijay. He was apparently convicted of raping and murdering at least 16 young boys. And we're talking boys ages 8 mm-hmm. to 15, and also some adults. And there's actually accounts that say he may have killed more than 40 wow. people in total. Yeah. And then we have another woman hater by the name of, they call him the cyclist killer, Farid Baghlani. And it looks like he killed between 15 women and girls and even a boy in a couple of cities there. And then there is a serial killer known as the Highway Killer, Omid Barak, who targeted women who cheated, or at least whom he believed cheated on their partners or spouses. And he's thought to have murdered at least 10 women in the Karaj area. I didn't even look at what the previous century had, because, I mean, the relevance was, is this story that I wrote about is more contemporary story.
Right. The man is murdered in 2006, and you say between February and May 2009, 5 women are murdered. And the first murder, there's right. no indication, obviously, that there's any serial killing involved. Take us to what happens after that first murder, and then obviously the second murder, and when there is some indication that a serial killer is underway.
Yeah, exactly. We start out with this man who is basically found murdered, and there's really nothing to suspect there's anything going on. And then when we've got some years pass, suddenly there's a spate of women being murdered, and there's a pattern. They're all older women. You know, so serial killers do tend to find a type. They do like their types. And so obviously that's what it looked like when the police start putting it together. Like, who are all these women, say ages late 50s through their 70s, that are being found murdered? And they're all strangled and their bodies are dumped. You know, there's a definite pattern here. So they start realizing that something's going on here. Obviously, early on, it's, you know, they don't wait till all 5 murders happen. They start investigating sooner than that. But yeah, there's definitely a pattern. There's eyewitness accounts that start having pieces put together about these women that are, you know, for instance, one woman was going at her lab, going for blood tests, and she's found dead. We have a woman who disappears from a shrine. We have a woman found murdered in her apartment, and there's just these parallels. And and one big parallel was the fact that their jewelry right. vanished,
and also they were
gold.
Also they were killed with their own headscarves.
Yeah. So the murders do get progressively more brutal as they go along as well. And then there is an indication that these women were possibly drugged, so therefore knocked out.
So police are wondering how this person could get to these victims, that they must have known them in some way, had some connection to them in some way.
Well, either a connection or, as was revealed later, the killer clearly got these victims to trust her, you know? So, I mean, you know, why? Of course, we have to realize, too, that Iran is a slightly different culture than the West, and perhaps people are not as suspicious of each other. You know, like, for instance, if some, say you're in one particular instance, the woman, one of the victims is at a shrine, and she's befriended by this other woman who comes along and says, oh, you know, let's pray together. And, you know, and it's a nice young woman. And perhaps you look upon this young woman as a daughter figure, sure. You know, she could conceivably be your daughter. And so she says, hey, do you want to lift home? You know, chances are you'll say, sure, why not? You know, you're not going to think anything of it, but that's how these women ended up becoming victims.
Now, finally, the police learn about all of this much, much later, but there is finally someone that comes forward. The community is frightened, but there finally is, you write, a credible witness that comes forward and has a harrowing tale to tell police.
Correct, yes. I mean, obviously, there's all the attention seekers who come forward before that, wasting police time and saying, oh, yes, you know, I was, you know, almost a victim, et cetera. But then they get this one woman who has a story to tell who was actually, the same thing happened at this same shrine in which one of the victims was murdered, taken and murdered. And she describes being befriended by this young lady, someone who, as I said, can conceivably be her daughter in age, offers her a lift. And then she keeps pushing this box of juice on her, like, let me drink this juice, this, you know, refresh yourself, have this juice, and pushing it and pushing it and pushing it. And the lady's starting to freak out, you know, thinking this, something's not right. And she's saying, please stop this car. I want to get out. I want to get out. And finally, she's allowed out of the car after she's banging on the car windows to get out. And it turns out that, you know, that was one of the things with the juice box being so, important in this story, is the juice box was drugged. It was laced with drugs to knock these victims out. So she is actually shown, and she gives like an EFIT rendering. And later on, you know, she's able to identify the woman, because the woman had been known to police before, because in some previous investigations as a potential suspect, along with other people, of course. So she's finally identifying who this serial killer is.
Now, once they do that, you write, though, that police don't believe for a second that this woman could have done all of this carnage herself, all this murderous damage herself. But still, they question her, and you say that she stays mum on this for 48 hours. Tell us what happens when she finally admits and starts telling police the details.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, it was just so unusual that they would even have a female serial killer, especially one that was able to strangle victims, dump bodies. I mean, this is, you know, quite a physical endeavor. And of course, culturally, they're not going to think a woman is doing what would be a man's job, so to speak. Mahin, our serial killer in the story, finally does confess, because so much evidence is found in her apartment. She just cannot explain away, no matter how hard she tries to explain it away. And, you know, of course, they also think her husband was involved, and he wasn't. He wasn't, and he was not her partner in crime. So she finally does break down and confesses to almost all the murders, but she holds back on one of the murders for a couple of valid reasons. One of them is the fact that the victim was actually related to her. It was her aunt-in-law, namely her mother-in-law's sister. And her mother-in-law is basically the only person who really tried to help her with her financial difficulties. Unfortunately, Mahin had a child with cerebral palsy. So you can see that there was a lot of things going on and the need for money and her financial situation. So she held back on confessing to that one murder until she knew someone would be there to look after her sick child. And then she finally spilled the beans, as it were.
Well, like I said, and you write, that police still don't believe that she did it all herself. And they insist that she go along with them to the crime sites and also do a reconstruction of the murders for them.
Yes, correct. And they were quite, you know, exactly. And they went to the site. They had her go through it, act through what she did, and it all added up 100%. There was just no doubt that she did it, and she did it on her own.
You write that she became very skilled in this killing and saw it as a business, fleecing these women of their jewelry. She thought that she was less guilty by killing older women. She also learned things like putting a bunch of objects in the front seat, so it necessitated these people that she was giving a ride to go in the back, which would mean that less people might notice the person in the back. And you also talked about the killer wearing something that would make her less noticeable to any witness.
Yeah, she tried to be as anonymous as possible by wearing the chador, which is sort of like this overgarment that, you know, it's, I mean, you've no doubt seen women who are totally covered with that you can't even see their under, you know, the clothes they have underneath, right. So that she's so hard to identify, because all you would see would be like this little round face showing, you know, you can't say, oh, it was the lady with the colorful headscarf or whatever. She just completely made sure that she blended in with everybody else, you know, but the one determining factor in how the eyewitness accounts and whatever was her car. It wasn't necessarily her physical description. It was the car, right, she drove that was a dead giveaway. It was an older model Renault. Mm-hmm.
She also gave a full confession and was griping about the treatment from these drug dealers that she sought out to get sedatives to knock out her victims. And also later, she wanted to get a gun to speed up the whole process. Tell us, as you do, that as you write, her misfortune dealing with people unscrupulous. Surprise, surprise.
I know. Yeah, it's almost comic, really. I mean, you know, they no doubt she obviously wanted these drugs to get into the boxes of juice. So she heard that there was this one street in Tehran, in the capital, the Iran's capital, that you could get anything, absolutely anything. And she went down there and she hooked up with these drug dealers. They sold her this so-called foreign drug, this, you know, wonderful drug that was going to do everything that she needed it to do, which it was later revealed it was just stuff that she could have got at the pharmacy herself and mixed together. I mean, obviously they saw her coming, you know. I mean, they probably didn't get a lot of customers like that coming over. And then she decided to up her game a bit, you know, maybe incorporate a gun. So she sought these guys out again. She also sought them out for fake receipts for mm-hmm. gold, because she obviously had to sell the gold that she was right. stealing. That was the whole point. She needed the money, so she sold the gold. So they gave her that. Apparently that worked sure. okay. But when she wanted the gun, they sold her, you know, they sold her this supposed gun in the box, and she wants to check the box. And they basically shamed her into like not opening it, you know, as you would expect. And she doesn't find out until later it's a piece of metal.
Yeah. And you write too that test out the poisons the sedative value of these drugs she had bought from these dealers. She tested it out on her husband.
Yes, I found that kind of funny, because he claimed he was like unconscious for days, and he called her a devil for doing that. But I mean, as one would read the story, there isn't a lot of sympathy to be had for Mahin's husband. I mean, he contributed to a lot of the problems that she had financially.
This case veers off, interestingly, and it sounds a little bit like Aileen Wuornos's claim that she became involved in killing men out of self-defense. It didn't have much credibility as details of the, you know, of the first murder, then the subsequent murders lent no credibility to her claim. But you talk about that this woman made the same sort of claim about her landlord, and that was the first murder. Tell us about that.
Yes, exactly. That was the man that was found dumped. But then again, we had this several year gap before she started killing women. But apparently, he had taken quite a fancy to her and essentially was hounding her, you know, like, oh, you know, come away with me. You know, let's run off together. You know, I'll marry you. I mean, he was already married, but that doesn't matter. It was getting kind of, it was just getting bad. There were reports, one of Mahin's daughters says that she saw him fondling Mahin's undergarments that were hanging on the clothesline in the courtyard. I mean, getting really pervy here. Apparently, there was a confrontation that ended up going, he lived in the same building. He was like upstairs. So it's not like she could avoid this man. And she was getting panicked because, you know, in Iran, if you're accused or supposedly if you are, you know, an adulterer, that comes with a death penalty.
Incredible.
So we're this is pretty serious stuff here. So this landlord was becoming enough of a problem, and it ended up becoming this altercation. She killed him. I don't believe, from what I understand, that it was anything premeditated. She just lashed out, and this is what happened. And it launched her into having to get rid of his body, dumping his body, et cetera. And, you know, I kind of surmise that perhaps she just exploded already with the powerlessness that she had. And this perhaps set her on her future career, shall we say?
Well, I'm not to disagree with you, but she was very cool-headed, very much like a serial killer in the planning. And then the post-killing, she went very calmly after getting rid of a body or putting a body in a trunk and then going picking up her kids and acting very, very normal.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. But, you know, again, with the killings, each woman that she killed, it did progress. I mean, there was a lot of, apparently her first female victim, she was uncertain if she was going to kill her, but then she just realized, well, you know, I can be identified. And that started it. But there was some remorse at the beginning, but as the killings progressed, I guess she just sort of, you know, went with the flow and became accustomed to it. And as you say, became increasingly calculated in the killings until she probably, in a way, divorced herself from the humanity of her victims.
What did she have to say in terms of the rationale for the murder of her relative? You say this is the only person, she said, that was the only person that ever cared for her, aided her in any way, and yet...
Well, no, it wasn't that. It was the aunt-in-law. So that was her mother-in-law's sister she killed. And it was the mother-in-law that was was the only person who helped. That's why she was not confessing to that particular murder. But I guess she just saw this particular murder as being an easier target. She didn't have to actually go out and find the victim as she did with the other four women. So, you know, she went there one morning around breakfast time when nobody was around. She had her drugged box of juice. And, you know, apparently, I guess she knew that her aunt-in-law had jewelry in the house. You know, gold jewelry is just very, you know, it's very popular in Iran. You know, people love their gold jewelry there. And so, you know, she knew she'd cash in, and she obviously did.
Now, the husband gets dragged into the first murder. She comes to him because, as you had mentioned, that she had difficulty actually getting rid of that body. She went back a couple of days after she had dumped it into the canal, and it was still evidence. People could see the body. So she employed her husband to help.
Yeah, that's the only time apparently that he was actually involved in anything. She did finally get his body pushed off like an overpass, and it fell down below. And as you mentioned, she went back to check a couple of days later, and there was the wrapped up body still down there. And she needed help moving it. She wanted to move it underneath the overpass so it couldn't be seen from above. And that's where she recruited her husband. And I'm actually kind of surprised by that. You know, I would be surprised that she would even have asked him under the circumstances, but maybe she explained about the harassment that she was getting from him, and he went along with it. But from everything that came after that, he was not involved whatsoever in the serial killings of the women and apparently didn't know about them.
Now, let's talk about how she could possibly be a victim and how you write that there is any sympathy for this killer.
Well, you know, her circumstances, she was quite estranged from her family. The financial issues, you know, her husband was out of work and he was also a drug addict. He did not seem to contribute in any way to the household financially or even as moral support or taking care of the kids. And everything fell on her shoulders. Again, she has this child with cerebral palsy who needs treatment. This costs money. She'd also lost the employment she had. She was a driving instructor. And the car that she used, there was an accident. The car needed repairs. She didn't have money for the repairs. She didn't even have money to keep paying the payments on the car. So there was any income gone right there. Husband's not contributing. She even said in an interview that he did not do his job as a husband or provider or father. Her mother, which, I mean, there's been references that she targeted these women as a mother image kind of thing. And, you know, that may be true. Her mother seemed to be acting against her at every turn. When creditors came looking for Maheen and they would be like even going to her mother's house, her mother helpfully gave them Maheen's address and phone number so they can go and harass her for, you know, these debts. As she apparently, there was an inheritance from her father that the mother prevented her from getting. So there's money that could have solved a lot of problems, helped her with her child, helped her with the household bills that was prevented. So her mother doesn't sound like she was a very nice person or very supportive or really cared about her. So you've got that going on, got these financial pressures. She got into more debt because she took out a supposed loan, government loan, found out it was a con. There was no loan. The guy conned her. So then she had more debts. So all of this stuff is just piling and piling and piling up on her. And no, it doesn't justify going out and murdering women and stealing their gold. Of course it doesn't. But, you know, there's always another side. And in a way, she was a victim herself. And perhaps it was never going to end well for her.
Yeah, she right. She was only permitted to go to grade 3. She was married at 14 and all this misfortune. But also that she hated her mother and decided to take revenge.
Well, can you blame her, really?
Yeah.
You know, yeah, like I said, this she certainly didn't seem to get much support from her family. I mean, she had siblings and everything. And you know, she was very, everyone who knew her said she was a lovely lady. She was very lovable. I mean, even the people who had her under arrest said that. You know, she just, you know, there's just sometimes you just don't know what a person could be driven to. And it's just tragic no matter how you look at it.
Yeah, she writes, she was convicted on 6 counts of robbery and 6 counts of premeditated murder. For the robbery, she received 24 months, but 74 lashes. And for the murder, the death penalty.
Yeah, she was hanged. Yeah.
She said some interesting things, not in her own defense, regarding whether she should receive the death penalty.
Yeah, that she should be executed 6 times or something to that effect, she said in an interview. I mean, she obviously knew what she did. She wasn't trying to excuse it or, you know, fluff it off. She knew she was guilty. And I mean, then obviously deep down, she was sickened by the fact that she did these things. But, you know, as I said, there's just no telling what someone's going to do when they're pushed against the wall and when they're totally desperate like that.
You spoke to some filmmakers that did an award-winning documentary, and you got a chance to talk to them. Tell us what that conversation entailed.
Yeah, that was that was an extra perk when I found out that there was a documentary film made in 2018. I don't know if people are aware of it, but I mean, there is a vibrant filmmaking culture in Iran. They have film festivals and just like other countries do. And the film, which is called Maheen, has won several awards at different film festivals in Iran. So I spoke with the director and also the actor who played Maheen in the film. And I just kind of wanted to get their feedback about how they felt. And overall, the impression was that for instance, the media coverage this case got, that it was very, very one-sided. In fact, the actor, she said that the media made things up to just kind of pad their journalism about the case. One thing that they both stressed was what appealed to them the most about being involved in this film was that the social issues need to be looked at. And that, yes, you know, you could just be going along in your life, your everyday life, but then circumstances get on top of you. And there's, and if you don't have any kind of support or help, it could, things could go very, very bad, as they did for Maheen. So the social issues thing was very big with both the director and the actor.
They made a fascinating statement. They said Maheen was condemned more because she was a woman rather than a man.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably not too surprising. And especially for Iran, that's even less surprising. Sure. Yeah, exactly.
And not just Iran, I would say, though.
No, that's true. That's true. But I think also, you know, the fact that I think being so powerless in that kind of environment would have is even worse.
Yes, absolutely. Let's use this as an opportunity to hear these messages. Now, another one of the stories that's in this collection is Ruth Schneider, the original femme fatale. And you take us to January 13th, 1928, front page news, New York Daily News, and the headline in big letters, an exclamation mark, dead.
Yes, this the famous Ruth Schneider case. This was a woman who was very vilified by the media and the press. And we're at the beginning of the 20th century. I suppose that's no surprise. How this story jumped out at me was the fact that this case is what inspired the film Double Indemnity. Right. And I'm a film noir fan, and that is my absolute favorite film noir. And when I saw this story come in from the writer, I was like, yes, this is definitely going in the book. And the whole thing does end up becoming an insurance scam. But essentially, you know, Ruth Schneider, she was a young lady, stenographer, whatever she was, and she meets this man accidentally and ends up marrying him. And he's well established, and she figures it's a good match. It seemed like it was a good match. Then as the marriage progresses, there's a lot of he kind of just doesn't care anymore. You know, they used to have this more of a glittering lifestyle and wining and dining and going out on the town. And then it's like the minute they got married, it was like, oh, I'll just stay home. I don't care. And, you know, Ruth's a young lady. She wants to go out. She wants to have fun. You know, same thing happened when they had a child. He just wasn't that bothered. And so, I mean, I suppose it's only natural that her eyes strayed and she met a gentleman and began an affair with him. And things spiraled from there.
You say that this husband, Albert, he was furious when she told him she was pregnant, and even more furious when she told him that she was having a daughter.
Yeah. Not doesn't sound like a very nice guy, does he?
And he became a big drinker and not a nice guy when he drank either.
Correct. So obviously we've got Ruth is becoming increasingly involved with this Judd Gray, whom she met. And she's, you know, her husband, so she says, threatened to kill her on more than one occasion as well. Again, with, as you mentioned, the alcohol and all of that, he was not a nice drunk. And so, you know, she tells this stuff to her lover, and they kind of decide, well, you know, we better do something about this before, you know, he acts first and kills you. So they hatch a plan. And it involves insurance fraud, which is basically, you know, the double indemnity I referenced earlier, which is a major part of the story, is, you know, that you'll get double the insurance if someone is either through suicide or murder or whatever. And so that was the plan, was to get this nice chunk of money and get rid of Albert. But, you know, Ruth tried to kill her husband several times before. It's almost comical mm-hmm. that it's as if no matter what she did, it didn't work. I think she tried to get him in the garage with the car, with the exhaust fumes. That didn't work. She tried all kinds of things and this guy just wouldn't go. I guess they figured, well, okay, we need to come up with a plan. And they did come up with a so-called burglary gone wrong plan.
You say, though, that she just came to be, an insurance man came to the door, and he was very, very ambitious because she wanted to take out yes. $50,000 on her husband in this double indemnity. And she obviously needed her husband's approval and permission and signature. So, as yeah. you write, this insurance man was so eager to do business that he allowed her to set the details on how that would happen. And she said she would get a blank signature on a blank piece of paper and use that.
Yeah, essentially, out of all the insurance that was taken out on him, only one, I believe, was legitimate. And it's the only one that got paid off at the end. And it was very paltry. But yes, so the insurance guy was also up on fraud and forgery charges. So he was not innocent in this either, although I don't think he suspected where this was going to go. But so it was basically, yes, to cash in on this insurance. And as you know, whenever you have, like, for instance, partners in crime, I think we've seen it time and time again that when they're both finally caught, then the finger pointing starts. Sure. And it's like, no, he did it, she did it. And that is basically how this what ends up happening here is each one accuses the other and that they're the ringmaster. They're the ones who thought of it. They're the ones who did the actual killing. So it became one great big mess. But basically, they both ended up falling down for it.
It's an incredible plan that they cook up to be able to kill the husband.
Well, yeah, very, very slick, actually, because they set it up first where, as I said, it was staged as a burglary gone wrong, but they actually got very clever where they set it up beforehand where Judd, Ruth's lover, there was a supposed prowler who was spotted maybe a few days or a week or so before. So there was already a report of this supposed prowler who was seen around the house. So that set it up beautifully for the actual burglary, whereas the prowler obviously gained entry sometime in the middle of the night. Ruth and her husband, Albert, had come home from a party, which a very unfortunate party because Albert had been drinking and he was being nasty and there was this fight. And so they just left and they came home. The daughter was staying somewhere else because, you know, obviously she had to be looked after while her parents right. were out. And so Ruth cleverly, she left the door unlocked so Judd could come in. And the whole plan was basically to kill Albert in his bed. And then Ruth would stage it so that she supposedly was also almost killed, you know, like whacked over the head and was found unconscious. but, you know, it all unraveled because all these things she said that was done and being unconscious for hours and hours and hours, there was no actual evidence that, well, there's nothing wrong with your head. There's no evidence that somebody whacked you on the head that would render you unconscious for several hours. So, I mean, her whole story and all this stuff she was telling the police, they started to say, this is not adding up.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, that the husband is found with a picture wire tightly wrapped around his neck. And then you talk about all of this evidence, blatant evidence against her found, and yet both of these people start pointing the finger and both of them come up, and especially her, with some incredible stories to try to explain.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, well, Judd himself set the stage, you know, as well. He was supposedly out of town and he set it up where he was like, you know, seen at the front, you know, at the front desk, or he was checking his messages, or he took a bath. There was, you know, water in the bathtub in the morning. So it's like, well, no, he's out of town. How could he possibly be, you know, in New York or wherever doing this when he was not even, you know, nowhere near there? He was at this hotel in another city. So, I mean, he quite cleverly set it up, but his story fell through because of a very conscientious hotel maid. which I guess they never expected that to happen, who kept something that ended up proving that that Judd's story was also fabricated. But, you know, what's interesting is, as Ruth also kind of played herself up as this victim coming in, you know, to the trial with her rosary beads and the whole thing.
Yes, but they found some damning evidence, like a chloroform rag under his head, the husband's head. Her daughter awoke because the mother was making a lot of noise, but her feet were tied, but her hands weren't tied. So, and later she said, well, she just got bored waiting for somebody to discover. So all that planning was for naught, because the post-murder cover-up was very, very sloppy.
Yeah. You know, she was a self-defeating thing, you know, that she's bored waiting around for somebody to discover her being tied up. And then she goes and gets herself into the hallway. And, you know, that obviously starts throwing up some questions somewhere. Perhaps they would have gotten away with it if she would have stuck to the plan, but she didn't.
Yes. And you just mentioned about that person that cleaned up the room, but also took that wastebasket out of the room once she knew what had happened, and then called police after with that. Without that, there might not have been the verdict or the result for police.
Exactly. Yeah, I believe it was a train ticket that was found in the waste paper basket. And how could you, you know, if you weren't on the train, if you hadn't been in that city, then how would there be a train ticket there? So that unraveled it. And, you know, Judd enlisted a friend of his as well to kind of, you know, help him cover his tracks, although that friend had no idea what it involved. He thought it was some kind of a romantic tryst.
It's very interesting, just like the last story when we said that the documentary journalist had remarked that the woman involved was much more persecuted than any man would have. In this particular case, you say that Ruth had already had been convicted in the court of public opinion. And yet the husband had sympathetic treatment in the press.
Yeah, Ruth was really vilified by this. I mean, you know, that she became this hated person, this horrible, horrible monster for doing what she did. You know, no one talked about the abuse she got from her husband, Albert, or even the fact that, you know, he apparently threatened to kill her, which, you know, I can easily believe that was true, going by his behavior toward her. But yeah, I mean, the press hated her, politicians hated her, everybody hated her. She had, you know, disparaging nicknames in the press, which is, I think we've seen that with many cases, though sure, that's not unusual. But yeah, I mean, when she was finally executed, it was like a celebration that had happened, almost like, you know, when Ted Bundy was executed, that was like people did celebrate that.
Sure.
But I don't know if you can compare Ruth Snyder to Ted Bundy. I mean, you know what I mean? Sure. I just don't think there's any comparison.
No. And the apparently the defense, you write, was very simple for her husband, was that he was dominated by a serpent-like person with extraordinary powers, and he was helpless.
Yeah, her lover, yeah, Judd, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's laughable the way that it was described in the press. You know, she was that. Hence the name of the story, the original femme fatale. I mean, I suppose that's a valid point. You know, she roped in this poor innocent young man into this horrible plot. You know.
Now, there's a part of the story that I mentioned when I spoke to you earlier that our audience has heard about, and this is this famous photo of an electric chair, someone being executed in an electric chair, and secretly a photo being taken. Tell us about that.
Yes, well, I mean, you weren't supposed to take photos in the execution chamber. Photojournalist did get in there, and he strapped a camera to his leg, to his calf, I believe, and I guess obviously he had to tug up his trouser cuff a bit so that the camera would be there. And so he snapped the photo right at the time of execution, but it was a bit shaky. And so as a result, he had this million-dollar photo, and they had to kind of work on it and touch it up, and it almost looks like a painting. But yeah, that's the actual photo that was taken at the moment of execution, and the moment that people, you know, celebrated. But because of all the hot water he was in taking this photo when he should not have, it seems like he left the country for a while just to kind of wait for things to cool down.
You write in 1936, James Kane, a reporter who had covered the story, wrote a serialized story for a magazine, which led to a novel, which you say led to, inevitably, the film production of Double Indemnity.
Yeah, that was it was the story first, and then the novel, and then Raymond Chandler and Billy Wilder, those names should be familiar to people who are film buffs. They adapted it into a screenplay with Barbara Stanwyck, Fred McMurray. I love that film. I totally love that film. Of course, it was definitely more fictionalized, and the killing is different. And in this case, in the film version, obviously we have the insurance man who becomes embroiled in this plot to kill the husband. So it's quite different from the actual Ruth Snyder case itself.
Right. Let's use this opportunity to stop to hear these messages. Now, we have time to talk about one more incredible story in this incredible collection. And this is Innocence Taken, Mike Brown. And the setting is in Bridgewater, Nova Scotia, Canada, population 8,800, a 60-minute drive from the province's capital, which is Halifax. You say where murder was exceedingly rare, and the author, Mike Brown, worked at a coffee shop and a convenience store called the Candy Center. And one of the customers there was a person named Joseph John Laurendeau, a talented musician. So you take us to Halloween 1992, or in this story, Halloween 1992, where John was stabbed in his car at a poorly lit trailer park. What happens to John after that?
Well, this was this is what one of the things that shook up the whole town is the fact that there was this murder. And, you know, the author, Mike, sets this up as that's the only murder that he can actually remember happening. And I'm trying to think of what it was happened to this actual guy. It was a manslaughter case. Apparently, this guy was supposedly in his car smoking a joint, and John made a supposed homosexual advance, and he was murdered because of that. And there was a connection with the fire department when the author, who had actually was a member of the junior fire department, and he knew several of these people who were also involved in that. So that's how he knew Charles Zwicker, who was the killer of this of the gentleman, of John. And so the details just were something that, you know, it was just one of these things that everybody just talked about, and they just, it was, I guess, their one big killing that reverberated in the town. But that was quickly replaced in 2008 when Carissa Boudreau disappeared, a 12-year-old girl, which is the subject of this story, Innocence Taken, where it turns out people thought it was a kidnapping, or maybe somehow she ran away from home because there was a lot of things going on in the household. She was upset. She was frustrated. You know, there was a lot of things going on with her mother, with the husband or the partner, in and out, different households, living with this, with her mother here, living with the father, living with the stepfather. So, I mean, she was kind of a textbook case of someone, of a little girl who might run away from home. But that's not quite what happened, because eventually her body is discovered, and it's very surprising who is the person who killed her.
You write about January 27, 2008, and Carissa is a typical day. She's in her room playing video games. And you say that at that time she felt very, very isolated with this situation with her mother and her boyfriend and being away from her father. And so she felt isolated, and you write that her mother felt irritated by Carissa's behavior and suggested a car ride for a private conversation around 4 p.m. She dressed in jeans and just a t-shirt and a black hoodie and a winter vest and Crocs for shoes, which will not be appropriate for that kind of weather, but they were going for a ride. And so tell us what Penny says when she reports her daughter missing. What does she tell police happened?
Well, she is, they're at a supermarket parking lot. And so she supposedly left her daughter in the car. Her daughter was quite angry, apparently. And then she comes back 15 minutes later, and there's Carissa is not in the car. So supposedly, you know, her mother's saying she's searching the parking lot, driving all over the neighborhood, looking around for hours, and then she finally calls the police. So, I mean, you know, it clearly seems like, you know, it's a kid who's just run off. Mind you, as you mentioned, her attire was certainly not suitable for winter in Nova Scotia. So you have to wonder, well, she couldn't have gone very far. This whole thing just snowballed and snowballed. The whole town is starting to panic. You know, what happened to this little girl? This, you know, something, people are searching, everybody's out looking. Nothing is actually thought that there's anything suspicious of that, you know, perhaps a family member was involved. That's not even something that anyone considered at that time.
Yes, and you talk about Penny doing these emotional press conferences, crying and asking for her daughter to return. And in fact, it was two press conferences, and she made these emotional pleas.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think we've probably seen that in cases before where a parent was involved in the killing of a child, of their own child. But yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you know, it was just everybody was on the father, and I mean, you know, the father did not have anything to do with this. So let's clarify that. But yeah, so I mean, it was quite a convincing performance for the cameras.
You say too that the police are again not helped by the public with these several unconfirmed sightings. And so there was no reason to doubt Penny's account. There was, you write, though, online speculation at that time, but the Lehave River was searched by divers from the RCMP. So there was helicopters. There was an extensive search for this young girl.
Yeah, yeah. It's strange that, I mean, they did not find anything, but then it was, again, a sort of an accidental thing where one, I think it was a truck driver or somebody who was driving on this highway, saw something at the side of the road. It was a pink Croc, you know, the shoe. And then sometime later, again, something totally random with this family passing through town. They stopped. There was a little boy. He wanted to, you know, have a little leak at the side of the road. Yeah. And that's when he saw what appeared to be a body down in like a ravine or whatever it was. And that's when they finally discovered that it was Carissa. It was all very cleverly staged as well, because it looked for all intents and purposes like she'd been a victim of a sexual assault. You know, with the clothes are all, you know, with pants down, a bra, you know, askew or whatever. So, I mean, it looked like definitely that's what would have happened. And, you know, that would be the first thing people would assume anyways, you know, a young girl's missing. That's generally, sadly, their fate in many cases. Very, very cleverly staged. So once again, you would not suspect it was like, you know, her own mother.
It's interesting, too, that there are red marks consistent with ligature marks at her neck and groin specifically. And they police determined that somebody had placed the body. This was not the crime scene. So that they placed the body at the scene shortly after death. And a lot of evidence was held back by police, obviously, of course. But when Penny and Vernon were notified about the discovery, they reacted strangely, police said.
Yeah, there was just not really any emotion. Vernon was Penny's current boyfriend with whom she was living. And this, again, created problems in the household with Carissa, because she just didn't like having Vernon living with them. You know, she just didn't want him there. It's not that he did anything. But in Vernon's case, you know, he did not actually have any involvement with what happened to Carissa. But it seems that he suspected his girlfriend was involved, and he was concerned, I suppose, really watching his own back, not wanting to say too much because he didn't want to be implicated in this.
It's very interesting that police are suspicious, so they put the couple under surveillance.
Yeah, they planned a whole little Mr. Big operation, is known in Canadian law enforcement. I'm not actually sure. I imagine it must be elsewhere as well. But how it was set up was, this is how they actually got them. For people who don't know what a Mr. Big
Right.
operation is, they all law enforcement sort of set up this, especially in a cold case when they don't have anything and they need to try to prompt some kind of thing to happen. They set it up whereas they kind of suck you in. For instance, in this case, we've got Penny and Vernon. They're kind of persona non grata. They've actually left town because it was just so unpleasant already. Vernon had been in jail for something or other. I can't quite recall, but he meets someone in jail who befriends him, and they keep running into this same guy. Apparently, there's supposedly money to be made. They get more involved with this guy, and he's going to introduce you to this one, and then this one, and eventually the Mr. Big person who's running the show. So they get you to do little tasks, small ones at first. They get bigger and bigger and bigger, generally involving something illegal, but also to prove that, you're going to be, into this, and you're not going to, run off or perhaps rat on them. They want you to disclose something about yourself, something that, in a way, they can hold back as, as a guarantee. And that's how it ends up being, where Penny tells them exactly what happened, that she killed her daughter Carissa, and she describes in detail exactly what she did. And that's when the noose comes down.
Yes, it's interesting. She says that her daughter said, as she strangled her, "Mommy, don't."
Yeah, that really that was something that upset everybody. Even the judge in the trial was just so sickened by that. I mean, it's just almost mind-boggling that she kept going to that level that she did, to totally kill her daughter, with her daughter pleading with her. But I don't know. She definitely wanted rid of her, and that was that.
As a result of this extraordinary Mr. Big operation, which now I believe is outlawed in Canada, but she was arrested on June 14th and sentenced in 2009. Again, the judge was disgusted, but he gave her 20 years till parole eligibility, life sentence being the 25 years to life. But
Yeah.
shockingly, I'm doing some math here. The parole board has got this woman beginning to have day passes, and maybe you could, I don't know if you could tell us about day passes, but they have day passes in advance of a potential first parole hearing. And so
Yeah.
since 2018, she's had day passes outside of that prison.
Yeah, well, actually, they gave her a lesser sentence for the reason that they felt that so much pain had already been caused, and they just wanted to put paid to it. So, hence, that opened the door for this whole parole thing. So, yeah, she was being granted these day passes to do like personal things. So, there were like supposed visits for church services
Right.
and things along those things. And she would get more and more and more of these passes. And of course, obviously, nobody is happy about this.
Right.
And there was protests lodged about it. But there some of these things are just, she's just getting more and more of these, even escorted visits to friends, as I get again, like the church, personal development activities. Even so, I don't know. It almost seems like maybe they should have held out for a stricter sentence.
Or if you're going to do your crimes, come to Canada.
Well,
Best end
I
results.
guess.
Wow. I want to thank you very much, Mitzi Soretto, for coming on and talking about your latest collection, Women Who Murder. For those that might want to take another look, or a further look, I should say, could you tell us about your website and any social media you do?
Sure. Well, I have my main website, which is MitziSoretto.com, and I'm on pretty much every social media site there is, from the former Twitter, to everything, you know, Blue Sky, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. So I have all my social media links on my website and all my books. The book's up there as well, and it's got some stores that you can find it if you want to just click on those. And basically, that's it. So, you know, I hope everyone will find the book to be a good book to read. I hope so. We've all felt that it is. We've worked very hard. So
absolutely. Thank you so much for this interview, Mitzi Soretto, Women Who Murder. Thank you so much for this interview, and you have a great evening and good night.